Hi, Michael Goldfarb in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. On the 2nd of May, 1808, the people of Madrid rose up against the rule of Joseph Bonaparte, installed on the Spanish throne by his brother Napoleon. It was a short-lived insurrection. By the 3rd of May, the reprisals had begun, and Napoleon's firing squads were at work, slaughtering the insurrectionists. 6 years later, the painter Francisco Goya y Luciente documented the scene. In a black midnight, a man in a white shirt, his arms flung open, his features filled with an astonishing range of emotion, looks down the gun barrels of a faceless firing squad. At his feet are the bodies of those already dead, coming out of the darkness, those who will follow him before the guns. It's probably the first image of what we in the modern world have become all too familiar with. In that man's face, you can read the final terror and acceptance of those executed everywhere in the 2 centuries since it was painted, from the courtyard of the Lubyanka to the alleys of Bosnian villages to Saddam's prison at Abu Ghraib and 1,000 other places on every continent. Goya's almost 200-year-old painting is as modern can be. But the man who painted it was a classicist as well. That's the view of art critic Robert Hughes, whose mind has been occupied, maybe preoccupied, with Goya's imagery since he was a teenager a while ago in Australia. Now he has finally written about the Spanish genius, and he's here to talk about Goya. Connection listeners, Robert Hughes calls Goya the first modern visual reporter on warfare. What do you think? What sets Goya's renderings of warfare apart from the painters who came before and after him? What sets Goya's paintings apart for you? 800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. And listeners, if you're at your desk and you can, you know, keep the boss away, you can go to our website, theconnection.org, where we've got a whole gallery of images of Goya paintings and etchings, and you can look at them as I talk about them with my guest, Robert Hughes, who's joining us now. He's in a studio in Miami. Robert Hughes is the author of many books, including The Shock of the New and The Fatal Shore. His most recent one is called Goya. And of course, he was the art critic for Time magazine for more than 30 years. Welcome, Robert Hughes.
Thank you, sir.
Now, Robert, you start the book, and perhaps we should start the conversation by talking about the extraordinarily personal connection you feel to this artist.
Well, nobody's really got a personal connection to the dead. But I've always had a kind of obsessive interest in Goya, a mixture of reverence and enjoyment. And you know, it really started when I was a teenager because I happened to find in a junk shop a late state. You know, prints are sometimes reprinted from the copper plates, and this was a late print of a very famous picture of Goya's, which even I, as an Australian teenager, had heard of, which bore the title El Sueño de la Razón Produce Monstruos, The Dream of Reason Brings Forth Monsters. And, of course, it's one of the most famous images in all Western art. It's the man asleep at a desk, slumped on the desk, with all these bats and owls and other creatures from the dark side fluttering around his head. And that statement, El Sueño de la Razón, inscribed on the side of the desk. And it just seemed to me to be, you know, the most extraordinary rendering of a bad dream, of insecurity, of the fragility of our grasp on the world. And so I bought it for £10.
How old were you then?
I was about 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a good little Jesuit schoolboy. And, of course, as I delved a little into Goya, I found that wow, how surprising. Here is this man 200 years ago who so vastly anticipated my own growing anti-clerical views and fears. And I found him just an incredibly brave and sympathetic witness to all sorts of stuff whose existence I was only fractionally aware of in that day, at that age.
And as you grew and made your life in art, writing about it as a critic in the broadest sense, you came to know his work very well, but you didn't.
Well, he was a talisman to me, you see. He became a talisman to me. The art world, like any other world, is full of bull. And the thing about Goya, as I began to discover, was that he never told a pictorial lie.
What does a pictorial lie look like?
Not much. It looks like something you don't believe in. It has a funny smell. It smells of flattery and stuff that you don't want around when you think you're looking at art.
So when you say that, I guess just to press you on the point, what is a painting that a lot of people would know that is a pictorial lie, in your opinion?
Oh, my goodness.
Maybe a Spanish one.
There are some very grandiose pictorial lies. I mean, there are, a lot of paintings of important people things that are designed to reinforce the image, to pump up the image of the ruler. I mean, I suppose a good example of a benign pictorial lie, well, I don't know, we're not in England, so we probably don't know it in America, but there's a famous picture of Pietro Anagonis of Queen Elizabeth II when she was young, right off the top of a chocolate box. Pictorial lie, let me think. There are lots and lots of official portraits, including some American ones, even of Washington, that are rhetorical. You know, they surround the character with probably more grandeur, resolution, beauty than is actually there.
Okay, well...
A pictorial lie is a picture that tries to make war out to be glorious, for instance.
Right. Something Goya didn't do. And we'll talk about the war painting shortly, but I want to stay with you and why it took you so long to finally getting around to writing about him.
Because you have to live a life before you can write about Goya, that's why. He's a very, in some respects, difficult artist because he paints a lot about suffering, a lot about betrayal, a lot about conflict, a lot about all sorts of things that you don't know about when you're a teenager. And it took me a long time also because you have to understand the kinds of tradition which he draws on and others which he rejects. You know, you have to have to write coherently about Goya, you've got to have an experience of what he doesn't do as well as of what he does do. I mean, to write about Goya, it's good, for instance, to know about Peter Paul Rubens, who was such a radically different painter, and in many ways Goya's opposite.
But you have to have personal life experience.
You've got to have some personal life experience. I mean, you've got to have lived a life. Goya is not a painter for virgins.
You have to have no pain.
It's a good idea, although it's not something that you can possibly go out and seek. And I was lucky. I had a charmed life until this accident of mine 4 years ago. And then I really did, I think, come to understand more about Goya because I nearly died.
Yeah, tell listeners who may not know about this that you were actually back in Australia filming. And
yeah, back in the old home country. And I was filming a television series about Australia. And it was quite a long series. It was 8 parts. And maybe six, I'm sorry. And anyway, I had this really bad auto accident. I'd always been lucky. I'd always been spared this sort of thing before. But I'd been fishing over on the west coast, which is the desert coast of Western Australia. And I'd been out all day casting flies for small tuna. And I had a tuna in the back of the car, and I was driving back 100 miles north to where the rest of the crew was waiting. We were going to go filming the following day. And I set out in the early evening around sunset. And basically driving out of the cattle gate is all I remember. What happened was that I had a head-on collision with a car going the opposite way in the twilight. Car had 3 guys in it, 2 of whom were drug pushers, and the car had a lot of dope in the back. Who was stoned, I don't know. But anyway, I have no recollection of the impact. But what happened was that I was most of the bones on the right-hand side of my body were fragmented. I mean, there were 4 fractures of the right leg alone, 2 in the femur, 1 in the fibula, one in the tibia. And the impact just wrapped the car around me like, paper. And it took hours before the ambulance could be summoned from...
And you were recovering for months. And in
7
that
months in hospital and, a lot of stuff.
You write that in your sleep you saw Goya.
Yeah, I did. In intensive care, you have these really weird, intense kind of narrative dreams or hallucinations. I mean, people think that a person just lying there like a fish on a slab in intensive care isn't experiencing anything. Well, it's really not true. You know, I'm here to tell you that, you know, it was just one of the weirdest psychic narratives that I've ever experienced. And because I was feeling so guilty about not having got this book properly underway, I conjured up this presence of Goya in my head, and there he was, you know, dressed in his bullfighter costume, like that portrait he did when he was in his 40s, with the candles around the brim of his hat. And he said to me, "You know something? You're an you're an Inglés asqueroso. You're a disgusting Englishman," which I'm not. I mean, I'm maybe disgusting, but I'm not English. "You're a disgusting Englishman, and you're never going to get me right, so why don't you give it up right now?" And then he and his friends, who were this bunch of mahos or street toughs, put this fetter on my leg, which was a complicated-looking iron object which looked as if it came out of one of his own dungeons. Now, this had a certain correlation with reality, because the doctors had put a fetter on my leg in the form of a fiendish contraption called an Isakoff brace, which had spikes that ran inwards and went through the skin and flesh into the bones and screwed them in, held the bones in a correct anatomical position to one another so that they would, you know, heal correctly. Not the prettiest of objects, but one necessary if I was going to ever walk again. And so anyway, what with Goya being so discouraging and there being so much, you know, horrible stuff from the accident and the, and 12 operations, one after another, over the next few years, I figured that I really, even if I were to write a book about Goya and get it wrong, I couldn't make it any worse than it already was. And in some curious kind of way, it broke my writer's block, and I was able to go at him.
Just a quick question, because we are coming up to the break. Did Goya speak to you in Spanish in your dream? He did.
In my dream. I was constantly addressing the Australian doctors and nurses in Spanish, and of course they didn't speak a word of it. And eventually they, you know, I asked for paper and pencil, or so I'm told, and this was brought. And I wrote with my one good hand on this paper, "I am dissatisfied with the accommodations here. Please take me to a good hotel." In Spanish.
Yeah. Yes, that's not the title of a Goya.
No, me gusta las habitaciones aquí.
Okay, and that's not the title of a Goya etching.
No, it could be, but it's not.
It could be, yes. Okay, we are coming up to the break, Robert. And Connection listeners, we're talking with Robert Hughes, the art critic, who's written a pretty terrific book about Goya, a man he lived with for, how many years? 50-odd years before you actually sat down to write about him thoroughly. 800-423-8255 is the number to call. 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in a conversation about Goya. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about the honest paintings of Goya. We're going to talk about him as the first modern reporter of war. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour, Connection listeners, with Robert Hughes, the art critic who's just published a large study of Goya. We're talking about Goya as the in Robert Hughes' words, what are they? They're right in front of me.
There's about 150,000 of them.
But we're talking about the hinge point in the history of art, Robert. The hinge figure between the old masters and the truly modern. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation with Robert Hughes. Robert, in that first segment, you were talking about the honesty of Goya, that he never made a dishonest painting. And what I'm really curious about is, how did he walk the fine balance between serving the powers that be, who paid his bills, that is to say the Spanish royal family, and being this man who was able to see with utter clarity the new and emerging modern world, people coming in from the countryside to the city and suffering all these terrors?
He managed to do it because he was just extremely comprehensive. I mean, there was nothing hypocritical about Goyer, although I don't doubt that sometimes he suppressed a certain distaste for some sitters in the interest of the work. He was the kind of man of whom we tend to have a rather imperfect picture today, because we think necessarily that anybody who is a really radical artist, which Goyer was, must be against all forms of authoritarian structure. If he works for royals, he must satirize them, etc., etc. But this isn't true of Goyer. I mean, he was a man of the 18th and not of the 21st century. And people think, there is, for instance, and I bet you know it, there's this wonderful big group portrait of the family of Carlos IV there in the Prado in Madrid. And people look at this group of decidedly dim, weird-looking inbred royals, and they think, well, what a fearless satirist he was. But, you know, the truth is that for a variety of reasons, if his sitters had known that he was satirizing them, he never would have got anywhere as a court portraitist. And it's something you can't disguise. I mean, my own feeling is that he made them probably look handsomer and more intelligent than they actually were. Certainly the painting, each figure was preceded by many studies, and these studies were shown to the person involved. So this picture of Goyer as a fearless social satirist putting his neck on the block every time he picked up a brush is hooey. He painted for all sorts of people, extreme conservatives, relative radicals, liberals, you know, et cetera, you name it. I mean, he just worked across the whole spectrum of Spanish power and politics.
Was he one of the first artists then who made a separate kind of private space for what he saw as a truthful vision? I mean, that's also something else we think of when we think of the modern, that, you know, there's the public painter who does what he has to do for money, but the real soul comes out in some place private, which we discover 100 years after they're dead.
Well, I think the real soul came out in the public painter too. But it's certainly true that he had not just a private side, but a vast private territory, which it was filled by his, you know, and this happens, this begins to fill up, and it creates the Goya that we know and love, at least that, you know, I love. Mm-hmm. I think it's the Goya that most people love, the really, you know, the crisis-ridden Goya, the man who is the great, you know, topographer of terror and even a mental breakdown, because he seems so modern. This Goya emerges with an illness that he had. He had this catastrophic attack of, we don't know what it was, but its main symptom was deafness, and that immured him in the prison of the self and created, some people think deafness is funny, it's not, and it created the private painter whose work we see.
I don't know how much of a written record there is, either from his own diaries or from
the are no diaries.
There are no diaries. It's just
sketchbooks. No, he didn't keep a diary. He wrote a few and very few sketchbooks. He wrote letters, but he didn't speak about his deafness very much in the letters. You know, he's not a figure given to self-disclosure in anything except his painting and drawing.
Do you wonder if his deafness had not also accompanied a time of great historic upheaval in Spain? Do you wonder if he might have been quite so intense in his vision? Or was he...
I wonder that, but it's something we can't actually know. Yeah. But the two coincide. They go hand in hand. And I think the deafness gives him incoherent experiences, and the struggle to give those form is also part of the struggle of rationalization, which goes with his understanding of politics.
The great images of war and the disasters of war, we'll talk later about the painting I wrote about earlier, the 3rd of May, 1808. But, I mean, the disasters of war, which inflame our imaginations today, and we can hardly believe that somebody 200 years ago actually saw these things or saw them in that way.
That was his motto written on the side of the pictures. Yo lo vi, I saw this.
I know. When I see that, I think, you know, would Robert Capa or Jim Noctway Right, I saw this at the bottom of a photograph of war.
Well, he might not need to, but, you know, it's no accident that Kappa, and I think Naktwe too, and other war photographers regarded and regard Goya as their, you know, their great progenitor. He was the great permitter. I mean, Goya drew things which did not exist in drawn form before, and they were true.
Did the pictures which inflame our imaginations today, did they inflame imaginations in their time?
Well, not really, because the difficulty was that although, you know, I mean, these are the disasters of war in particular are the greatest act of witnessing of the barbarity of the human species, not just of the French, that have ever been done. And they weren't seen until everybody had been dead for a long time. You know, Goya died in whenever it was, 1828, I think, and we should know that. The disasters of war weren't printed from the plates until 1863. So they had no immediate effect upon the society whose sins they commemorated.
When they were first seen by a wide public, did they have an immediate effect?
Not very much, any more than that of the Caprichos did. I mean, the Caprichos were a commercial flop. The only etching series Goya did that was immediately fairly successful was his series on bullfighting, the Tauromachia, which are the greatest sporting prints in the history of sport, if you can call it sport.
So what happened then is it's almost as if history had to catch up with Goya, and we had
yes.
to have the body count in excess of millions before people could look back and say, my God, this guy saw it all before it happened.
Well, you didn't have body counts that big in 1863, but essentially you're right. I mean, one of the great things that constitutes Goya's modernity is that he was really the first artist to see through all that disgusting flummery of the nobility of war, you know, the stuff that the propagandists talk, you know. For Goya, you know, Goya was not in the business of manufacturing figures analogous to Jessica Lynch. And he was just, as far as it was possible to be, a truth-teller, although a lot of the stuff in the disasters of war was stuff that he couldn't possibly have seen because he would have been killed if he had.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Will is on the line from Durham, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
There's been some controversy recently over the authenticity of the black paintings, whether or not they were actually done by Goya's hand or by his son or by someone else, and some Spanish scholars have started to cast a little doubt on that. I was wondering if that was something you treated in your book or what sort of professional opinion you had about
it. I'll tell you my professional opinion. First, I'll tell you why I didn't treat it in the book, because I didn't treat it in the book because I don't think the argument is worth a damn. It was advanced by a Spanish furniture historian called Junquera, and who thinks that the things were the black paintings, which were the ones on the walls of his house outside Madrid, the Quinta del Sordo, that they were done by, of all people, Goya's son, Javier. Now, the thing is, we have no record of any other paintings by Goya's son, although we know that he probably was a painter, since his father called him a pintor. But we don't know what his, you know, I mean, there are no documented paintings by him. We don't know what his work looked like. I think we're in the same position with that as with, I don't know of any really good scholars of painting, and particularly of Goya's painting, who think that they're by anybody but Goya. But it made a nice story for the Sunday Times. I think that basically it's hooey to say that anybody but he painted them. It's like, you know, those perfectly decent, honest scholars who, a few of them, thought that Francis Bacon wrote the tragedies of Shakespeare. It's the same kind of, and it runs up against the same problem. Okay, well, you know, if these plays weren't written by Shakespeare, then they were written by somebody exactly the same as Shakespeare who happened not to be called Shakespeare. No, look, I tell you, I don't believe this stuff for a second. The late work of Goya, other late works of Goya are too, you know, they're clearly cut from the same cloth as the black paintings. And the idea of any other authorship is unprovable and to me makes no sense.
Will, I want to thank you for your call. Mark is calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts.
Yes, Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Good morning.
Mr. Goldfarb had mentioned that Goya was a hinge painter that sort of represented the connection from the old masters to the modern painting. And I know you've talked a little bit about that, and I just wondered if you could elaborate just a bit more about that and talk a little bit about Goya's technique.
Well, I can't do both because both are very large subjects, but I might add that Goya's technique changes a lot over the years. However, the reason why I think of him as this great hinge figure is that you see him, he starts as an 18th century painter heavily influenced by Watteau doing these fêtes champêtres, you know, where all is deliciousness and light and, you know, we have this very elegant, not untruthful, but, you know, sort of very elegant commentary upon the street life of Madrid and the, you know, the fairs and the festivals and the theatre and so forth. And he ends up as this implacably, unreservedly dark, dark talent, you know. He ends up as somewhere between Dostoevsky and Dickens, you know. And his governing idea of the essential cruelty of human life, his pessimism about the possibility of redemption, his immense sadness about this, is what makes him, and above all his fierceness, is what makes him into a modern, I think.
Mark, what do you say? Does that answer your question? Do you agree with the notion of Goya as a hinge figure, but one who is accomplished as an old master and equally accomplished as a modernist?
Well, it's fascinating because, of course, many of the old masters, just technique-wise, would also start with an underpainting, and that kind of went away a little bit with the Impressionists, which came much later. I wonder if just to change just a little bit here, I wonder what Mr. Hughes thinks of the modern world of painting, and just if he could put a word in there about whether it's in good shape or bad shape, and I'll hang up and listen to his answer.
Okay, we'll try and keep that one even shorter than comments on technique from Goya.
Yeah, I got to tell you, you know, me trying to say what I think about the whole modern situation in painting is going to take more than, you know, the 2 minutes. Listen, to be very brief, I don't think we're living in one of the great periods for depictive art. I really don't. I mean, obviously, it's a great period for photography and film and so forth, which the 18th century could not have been. But I don't think we have today any painters who are as good as, for instance, Goya. We've got some good painters, but I don't want to make you a kind of batting list.
Okay. Mark, I want to thank you for your call. Linda is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, I want to say I love you. You are incredible.
I love you back.
Oh, my
if
God.
If that's what you really think.
I am bowled over by this guy.
You mean you love Robert Hughes and not me?
Goya also.
Listen, transfer your love to Goya. He's real. I'm just a voice in a box.
Well, I wanted to tell you, when I was 19, I went to the Prado, and I had a full-blown psychotic episode because of the Goyas. I had to run out of the Prado. I was
well. You're not the first person to whom that happened.
And for it's
very powerful stuff, isn't it?
I mean, you used the word inchoate. I mean, I still can't describe why. I have no idea, but I've been all of my life, and I'm now 56, been sort of, Goya has been in there, always.
Yeah, he gets in through your eyes.
Yes. And
like an earwig. He's an eyewig.
Exactly. Or maybe a soul wig. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But there are two paintings that I've always loved and I've never understood, but they stay with me, and they always come back to me. And I just wonder if you can tell me what you think.
Which are these?
There's one where two women are tossing a dummy up into the air.
El Pelele. It's one of the studies for the tapestry designs. It's a really, really, psychologically, it's an extraordinarily interesting picture because, you know, Goya, though he was a sublime genius, was not, of course, immune to the prevalent sexism of the 18th century. And one of the I mean, we're so holy and happy now, wow. But anyway, the thing about, I think what El Pelele is, it records a, you know, an absolutely standard kind of folk amusement game. You know, girls would get in a circle with a blanket, and then they'd toss up this straw-stuffed dummy of a man. Uh-huh. And, you know, on one level, it's just fun. On another level, Goya's painting of it, I think, records his genuinely felt anxiety that men were in some way losing their dominant status. It's a painting which is lightly about the fear of women.
Ah, and the second one is it's a banner, a huge banner with a big, menacing, grinning face on it.
Ah, that is not in the Prado. It's in the Academia de San Fernando, I think, and it's called The Burial of the Sardine. Am I right?
I don't know. That's
And a whole lot of people dancing and capering around underneath this banner.
Yes.
Well, it's it's a really pretty damn demonic picture.
Yeah.
And and it's scary and it's very powerful and it's quite small.
And I've just never forgotten that face.
Well, you never will either. And neither will I. Although I don't know whose face it is.
Right.
But what that picture is about is it's called The Burial of Sardine because it's the end of Lent. It's the end of the period during which you ate fish rather than meat, you know?
I see.
And so, you know, the sardine is symbolically buried. It's a ceremony that still sometimes goes on in southern Andalusia, but not anymore in Madrid.
Well, as you say, it's also about something else, obviously.
Sure. I mean, a lot of Goya is about something else.
Yeah. Well, that's the end of my comments. Thank you. This has been a joy.
Thank you.
Okay, Linda.
Thanks.
Thanks for your call. We're coming up to the end of this segment, listeners. And when we come back, we'll talk finally about the creation of the painting, the 3rd of May, 1808. Maybe talk about the Majas as well. With Robert Hughes, author of the book Goya, who is our guest in this hour. Who else has been to the Prado? Who else has had their inner brain whacked around by looking at his work? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection from NPR. Michael Goldfarb, this is The Connection. We're talking with the art critic Robert Hughes, whose new book is called Goya, and we're talking with him about Goya, perhaps briefly about the famous painting, The 3rd of May, 1808. Briefly, Robert, this is the painting that is both on the cover of the book and I think kind of, what is it, your choice of words, colonizes one's brain looking back.
Once seen, never forgotten, I think.
Yeah. One of the interesting things is the painting itself almost looks as if he just wrapped his paintbrush this way and that and came up with these images.
But, yeah, it's very roughly painted.
But presumably there was more thought and sketching that went into it than that. It isn't just some raw expression of emotion. That's the finished product.
No, it's not. But on the other hand, we hardly have any indication in his drawings of any of the shapes or bodies that are used in the 3rd of May, which is strange, actually. But he can't have been out on the street. We know he was in Madrid when those executions took place. We can't imagine, at least I can't imagine, that he was actually walking around near the Monte de Principe Pio, where that shooting was, with his little sketchbook, because he would have been killed. You know, the French didn't want witnesses to these things, so he probably never saw it. And yet he did see it in there. And what his preliminary relationship to the image was, we still don't have any idea.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Lorraine is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Lorraine.
Hi. I regrettably, I missed the first part of your show, but I loved Goya since History of Art way back in the late 40s. But two things I never saw then, and I certainly didn't see in the Prado, or I remember it, came in an exhibition at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. At a time
and what were these?
Huh?
What were these?
I can't remember whether they were both graphic arts or paintings, but one was, according to the wall label, a painting of a brothel where two elderly women were pushing at least one child, about 2 or 3 years old, towards a man who was facing opposite, and the understanding you got from the wall label was that this was they were pimping. And the other was three men who apparently were vampires, but I didn't know that until I got up close and read the label. They were holding a man spread-eagled in the air, and it said they
that
were...
That is a great picture.
Huh?
Yeah, Witches in the Air, it's called. Brujos en el Aire.
Yeah, and it said they were bloodsuckers, but if you saw it from across the room, you'd think it was more in, you know, what you're used to hearing about. To me, that was a portrayal of rape that I don't think I'd ever seen anywhere else. Have you? Is this something Goya?
Well, it's not really a portrayal of rape. What it is, it's a portrayal of witches sucking the blood of a victim with whom they are levitating in the air. And it is, I think, the most powerful of all Goya's witch paintings, and he did a lot because he was fascinated by that kind of, you know, that side of Spanish culture, you know, the old Spain, the black Spain, not the Spain of the enlightened minority of intellectuals who were his friends and with whom he tended to hang out, but the Spain of the common pueblo with all its sort of superstitions. This is another of the things that makes him such an amazingly powerful and, so to speak, transcultural painter.
Robert, our caller Lorraine saw that painting as one of rape. Now,
It's not rape.
But there is something about those figures.
It's not sexual rape.
I know. But you wouldn't be surprised to think of them as women, even though they're wearing long capes. Women figure in Goya's work.
Equally a huge subject.
Equally to war and madness.
It's a good trio.
It's a good trio. Women,
war, madness, and women.
Yes. And the most famous paintings are those the clothed and the nude Maja. Tell us a bit about them, because there's a vast range of urban myths about who the Maja is or was, and exactly how and why Goya came to paint them.
Right. I mean, Goya is always has been believed by many people to have been the lover of the Duchess of Alba, who was the most famous beauty in Spain in Goya's time. I try to argue in the book that this is probably not the case, though we can't really know. Would a famous beauty like her have taken as a lover a man 20, 30 years older than her? Well, actually, it could be, because, you know, beautiful girls have much older lovers all the time. And celebrities, which Goya was himself, tend to attract young ones. But there isn't really any evidence that he was her lover. He certainly painted her, and but what I think is quite certain is that the pictures in the Prado of the naked and clothed Majas, this girl in the costume of a Maja, which is, you know, was a sort of chic bohemian costume, that these two girls, who were the same girl, were not the Duchess of Alba, because at the time that they were painted, the Duchess of Alba was dying from two wasting diseases, tuberculosis and dengue fever, and nobody dying of dengue fever looks like the girl in the Prado with those amazing perky breasts. So but Goya was completely and totally heterosexual. He just adored women. He also feared them. He also, you know, he had every conceivable kind of complex feeling about all sorts of women. He painted their portraits. It's very unusual to paint one naked in those days. You know, the nude was not a big part of Spanish culture then. And the representation of women, including witches, including peasant girls, including whores, including, you know, aristocrats, was just a vast part of his work.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Dan is on the line from Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Hi there.
Hey, Dan.
I recently had the pleasure of seeing Goya's work at the Prado, and I was really struck by the sort of his sort of love of grotesqueness and exaggeration.
Yeah.
And when I saw these pieces, I guess I wasn't so much reminded of anything that goes on these days in sort of the fine art world, but it reminded me more of, you know, of people who work at the medium of cartooning and graphic novels and things like that. And I guess
You're quite right.
It reminded me a lot more of somebody like Joe Sacco or Robert Crumb than in anything I see in the sort of in the fine art world. And I was wondering if you couldn't maybe just comment a bit on whether you feel that there
well,
is
I know
a direct link or
Oh, yeah, sure there is. I mean, the influence, of course, flows the other way. I mean, Bob Crumb was a great admirer of Goya's. Goya invented, or at any rate, revitalized the idea of the graphic satire. In his series, the Caprichos, which he did around 1800, which grew out of his experience of English caricature, people like Rowlandson and Gilray, is an absolute landmark, a really important step in the evolution of graphic humor and of satire itself. So it's quite right that you would have been reminded of modern satirists by Goya. You know, he is one of their tribal gods.
But it's interesting, Robert. One review, I did read some reviews of the book, took you to task for not pointing out that the paintings often are cartoon-like, particularly the faces are cartoon-like, even on the 3rd of May, 1808, and that I think the reviewer seemed to think that cartoons and the kind of satirical view of humanity that, that Goya is depicting somehow was less than an attempt to paint the face with in a realistic way.
There's a whole chapter of the book on the Caprichos and on the role that caricature and exaggeration plays in Goya's art. So I somewhat disagree with the alleged lack which the reviewer was taking me to task for. He is constantly using caricatural techniques as a means of heightening the impact and reality of his figures. But also, you have to remember that there is a very, very fine line, a lot of the time, between caricature and portraiture. I don't know any, I mean, there are very few portraits that aren't in some sense caricatures, and they rely upon the exaggeration of certain facial traits. And sometimes he doesn't appear to be caricaturing at all, you know, such is the case with certain portraits. And other times he does appear to be caricaturing. But then, of course, we don't really know because we don't see the, we don't know what the people originally look like, which is part of the beef I have against people who think that his portraits of Carlos IV and his consort are actually caricatures. All we can say is, well, it's not all we can say, but we certainly can say that he was tremendously alive to whatever was, you know, grotesque and excessive in the human face, and that he tended to release this vividness probably more in his drawings and prints than he did in his paintings.
He had a remarkably long and productive life.
Huge.
Despite the tragedy of deafness.
900 pictures.
900 pictures after. In the catalog.
Yeah,
900
yeah.
pictures.
Hundreds of prints. Hundreds of drawings. He was very fecund.
And did he have a, well, with not much written record, I mean, in what one knows from other sources about him, did he have a sense of his own ability, his own talent?
Oh, yes. You know, he was very proud of his ability. He had no doubt that he was a very good painter and draftsman. But he suffered remarkably little from any kind of professional jealousy, I suppose, because he didn't have anybody much in Spain to be jealous of. You know, he was almost a one-man culture in the way that you could say that in a literary sense, Goethe in Germany was almost a one-man culture at about the same time. And he had no real rivals. There were people that he admired and respected and learnt from, like, for instance, the long-dead Velázquez. He also had a tremendous regard for certain English artists and and so on and so forth. But he really, he had no rivals. I mean, he didn't live in a jealous art world. Others were jealous of him.
Robert, we're coming up to the end of the hour, and which is a shame because I'm enjoying this enormously, and I know our listeners are. Just as a critic, when you weigh the work of anybody you're judging, this is sort of picking up on a point that somebody made earlier about contemporary art. How important is it to you as a critic that work have a moral force? Contemporary work has so very little, and I know that you have some strong views on that. But, I mean, as a critic, when you look at Goya, but other artists as well, and you're judging their greatness, how important is their moral vision to you?
Well, they're not great because they're moral. It's rather the reverse. There are wonderful artists who make no moral commentaries at all. You know, you think of Chardin, for instance, or Watteau. You know, Watteau expresses nostalgias and longings and ideas about paradise, but I don't think you could call him a moralizing artist. But there is room for the great moralizers, you know. I mean, there's room for the Dostoevskys and the Dickenses and even the Beethovens, if you can call Beethoven a moralizer. And Goya is certainly of their company.
I didn't mean to say moralizer, just having moral force. You know, when he writes, "I saw this," he does this for a moral reason. He wants whoever comes to look at this painting, this etching, at some point in the future to know it happened. It was
yes,
true.
exactly. And he is very insistent on that. But that is part of the great claim that the realist painter makes, that his work matters because it reflects a reality. It asserts a reality which otherwise you might be tempted to dismiss or be skeptical about. He's putting his own integrity on the line.
Robert Hughes, I want to thank you very, very much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure, and I hope someday to have a conversation face to face, not
absolutely
from Boston to Miami.
Yeah, all right, let's do it.
Oh, we'll do it. Robert Hughes' book is called Goya. It's exquisitely written and lavishly produced, and I commend it to you. The Connection is produced by Khalil Bird, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Ord Karitsky Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugerts. The Maha of the studio is Tara Murphy, our senior producer. I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.